In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, starting May 8th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Trello help power global collaboration for all teams so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. It's hard to think of a musical instrument with more enduring popularity than the piano. For more than 300 years, pianists have captivated audiences, while composers for piano have pushed the boundaries of music. In her new book, The Piano, A History in 100 Pieces, the author and pianist Susan Tomes tells this story by highlighting some of the most impressive pieces of piano music ever written and sharing the stories of the composers who penned them. Susan will be launching the book with a concert at Wigmore Hall this Friday, the 23rd of July, and I spoke to her to find out more. Your new book is a history of the piano, but told through 100 pieces. So let's go back to the very start. And if we'd gone back and witnessed one of the very earliest piano recitals, what kind of things would we have seen and heard?
Well, first of all, I should say, when we're talking about the earliest pianos, the piano was a kind of an instrument that developed from the earlier harpsichord and clavichord, which were a little bit different in the way that the string made a noise. And in the harpsichord, the string is essentially plucked by a little plectrum, which as the string moves past it, there comes a point where the plectrum plucks the string and a sharp, distinct noise is made. Now, when the piano was developed, there was a sort of different way of striking the string. So instead of using a plectrum, the string was hit from below with a little hammer covered in, well, first of all, leather, and then later on felt. And you can imagine that, you know, when a string is struck with a soft hammer, it makes a different noise from when it's plucked. And the harpsichord was rather a quiet instrument, best suited to being listened to if you were able to sit close to it. And the piano, as it developed, developed a larger range of tone, a bigger, you know, a bigger volume. and more nuances of tone. So it, as it developed, it started to become more suitable for being played in larger rooms and being played in public concerts and so on. You did start to get the first concerts where the piano was heard in public.
Do you think that that's part of the piano's appeal? Because when I was thinking about this, I think it's fair to argue that there's no instrument that's been as enduringly popular as the piano. Do you think that ability to entertain large crowds is part of the reason behind that?
Yes, it is an extraordinary thing, actually, that the piano for, I mean, it's over 250 years now, has been really, really popular. And in fact, the heyday of the piano was probably the sort of the mid-late 19th century and into the 20th century, where so many people had pianos in their homes and wanted to have pianos in their homes and aspired to have pianos in their homes, even if they didn't play the piano. It was just such a kind of a symbol of somehow being interested in culture, art and culture. And then I guess the piano has been very popular because it's one of the instruments that you can sort of lean forward and play a few notes and you will make a sound straight away. However, of course, there's a very big gulf between being able to do that and being able to play the piano, you know, in such a way that others would enjoy it. But I think the fact that the piano supports its own weight, gravity is on its side, and so that makes it possible to play with two hands on the keyboard, playing different strands of music with each hand. So I think that's what makes it sort of uniquely versatile and enjoyable for the pianist, because you don't need another player or other players to complete, you know, a piece of music. You can play a piece of music on your own, and I think that's what has made the piano, you know, so tremendously popular and valuable over the years.
What would you count as some of the milestone moments in the history of piano music?
In a way, that goes along with the composers themselves and the wonderful ideas they had for piano pieces. And then, of course, in my book, I start more or less with J.S. Bach, Johann Sebastian Bach, who is kind of still at the top of many people's list of favorite composers, even 300 years later. And his music, which was really written for harpsichord, but then just during Bach's lifetime, the piano was being developed. And we know that in the mid-18th century, Bach played the piano to Frederick the Great. And I think at that point, Bach had some criticisms of the sound of the piano. He wasn't satisfied with it. But the maker of the piano went away and thought about what had been said and introduced some improvements. And then gradually different piano makers and kind of came to the fore and started building instruments in different European countries. And as they did so, composers in those countries, you know, heard what was being developed. For example, when Joseph Haydn went to London in the 1790s, and he came from Vienna, where the pianos sounded, you know, Viennese. And then he came to London, where John Broadwood was making a distinctively English piano, which was a bit stronger in tone, more forceful than the Viennese pianos that Joseph Haydn was used to. And when he came to London and encountered these Broadwood pianos, he was very excited about it. And I think hearing these big English pianos gave him the idea that one could write in a bolder style with more contrasts of loud and soft. And then Broadwood, who must have been some kind of marketing genius, John Broadwood himself had the idea of sending Beethoven a Broadwood piano as a gift, and had a Broadwood piano actually taken to Vienna. Goodness knows how he managed that. And Beethoven was very enthusiastic about the Broadwood pianos. And so Beethoven at the time was sort of writing his great cycle of, is it 32 sonatas for solo piano? And I think hearing a more powerful piano probably had an influence on the way that Beethoven wrote for piano.
You, of course, are a player yourself, and you speak in the book about the experience of playing on what are now antique pianos as a contemporary player. What kind of insights does that give you about what it would have been like to hear these pianos played, and what were some of the challenges of playing different styles, older styles of pianos?
Well, it's partly when you realise how delicate these older pianos sounded, some of them, then and you realise that people sitting far away would not have been able to hear the kind of nuances of playing that sort of has an influence on you as a player. But then it's a funny thing about historical instruments that one often gets the feeling that if these composers could have heard our modern pianos, they would have liked them. They would have liked to hear their music played on today's pianos, because it sometimes seems as though, for example, with the music of Mozart or Schubert or Beethoven, it seems as though they envisaged a greater range of tone colours than was available to them, as though they were not exactly writing for the future, because I don't think that's quite the right way to look at it, but it's as though they somehow built into their musical conception that the possibility that there would be a greater range of tone colour and a range of volume available on the instruments of the future, and that their music would adapt to that. So it is sort of mysterious, because I have tried, say with the music of Johann Sebastian Bach, have tried playing it on harpsichords and on early pianos and on modern pianos. And I tend to feel that one can get the most out of it on the modern piano. I know that lots of people wouldn't agree. They would say it's essential to hear the sounds that Bach would have heard. But that's actually not possible for us today, because the sounds that Bach would have heard are different in many different ways, not just the instrument, but the way the room was set up, how noisy the environment was, you know, what was going past in the street, the air and the climate and the way that sound moves in the air, you know, in that place at that time. It's all different. So I think for us today, it's not good enough just to get hold of a piano that we know was in Bach's house and play it and think that we're hearing the sound that Bach was hearing, because so many of the parameters have changed.
Who are some of the composers that really ripped up the rule book, I guess, of what piano music meant at the time that they were writing?
Well, I think if we're moving on from Bach, Mozart and so on into the Romantic era, I think that's really where composers maybe started using the piano to its fullest capability, and particularly Frédéric Chopin in the 19th century and Franz Liszt, those two, both of whom were wonderful performers themselves, so wonderful pianists. And the music they wrote for the piano, which was partly designed as a vehicle for themselves to impress their audience with their own virtuosity. And they really seemed to use the piano from the top to the bottom, you know, so that they are really kind of rippling across the spectrum, you know, with the most incredible virtuosic effects, but also the most spine-tingling, you know, haunting, delicate kind of spiritual sounding effects, and all that which was very much part of the Romantic concept, the time in not just in music but in art and poetry as well, where they're very much seeking the individual voice and the individual soul and how it could be expressed. And Chopin and Liszt, I think they were both so good at making the piano do everything from whisper to thunder and roar, you know, and I think that makes their music just incredibly satisfying to play.
Well, I wanted to ask you about players as well as composers. Who were some of the most impressive virtuosos from history, and how do you think that they would stand up to today's best players?
I mean, that's so interesting, isn't it? Because we can only guess at what some of the celebrated players of the past sounded like, because we've only had recording for just over 100 years. And already I think it has become clear that when you listen to people who recorded in the very first years of recording, you get surprises when you hear, early recordings, because, for example, when I first started listening to historical recordings, and when I say historical, I mean around about 1900, that I had assumed that people then might play in a more, let's say, in a slower, more tentative style, perhaps less confident than today, but actually not a bit of it. Sometimes in the very earliest days of recording, you find that people are playing with tremendous dash and sweep and elan, and often at faster tempos than I was expecting. And I realized that you cannot make assumptions about how people played in the old days. And then when you realize that 100 years ago, people were sort of dashing things off with great, great momentum and confidence, it makes you realize that you can't make assumptions about how people played 200 years ago or 300 years ago, And I think we would probably be quite surprised if we could go back and, if it was possible to have a recording of Mozart playing. We might all be very surprised. Not just by the technical way he played the piano or the sound he made, but also the sort of timing. Talking about who would have made a great impression as a player 100 or 200 or 300 years ago, I think that's actually very hard to guess, because I suspect that if I heard some of the people that they thought were terrific in the 18th century, I might be rather shocked. So fashions come and go in sound and timing and of course presentation on the platform. For example, Franz Liszt, the great Hungarian pianist and composer, when he played, he had all sorts of platform gimmicks to make the audience love him more, such as coming on with a beautiful pair of gloves on his hands and then taking them off and tossing them into the audience for people to catch. I saw Novak Djokovic toss his trainers into the crowd at the end of his Wimbledon final the other day. Liszt used to do things like that, and he used to smoke cigars on the platform and likewise either throw the cigar butts into the audience. And apparently, ladies in the audience used to collect the cigar butts and put them in their cleavages like an ornament, which, I mean, today sounds absolutely bizarre.
He was a great showman then.
Yeah, a tremendous showman. Whereas Chopin, who was his contemporary, was not at all a show-off in that way, and actually found public performance quite stressful. And as time went on, he reduced the number of concerts that he played. And I think when people have tried to count up how many concerts Chopin actually played for a public audience, as opposed to playing in somebody's drawing room for a circle of connoisseurs, if you count up his actual public concerts for which people bought tickets and came along, something like 34 concerts in his career, which is incredible to a concert pianist of today, where they might be expecting to play 100 concerts a year. I think it just makes it really hard to say, who were the most impressive performers of history. But before the age of recording, we're really relying on the impressions of people who were in the audience or people who knew them and heard them and recorded what they thought. And sometimes you read these things thinking, I wish I'd heard that. I'm sure I would have thought the same. And sometimes you read it thinking, I bet I wouldn't have liked that. So it's all quite fascinating, the history of performance and the reception of performance.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
For a lot of piano music, particularly of the Romantic era, where they're using wider intervals and they require greater stretches between individual fingers to get your hands on big chords, that is easier for men. It just is.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
A lot of the pieces that you look at in the book are, you know, they're deeply embedded in historical context. So I'm thinking you've got a piano trio from Shostakovich, which was written during the Second World War. And you argue that you need to understand that context in order to understand the piece. Can you speak a little bit more about that and perhaps some other pieces that were really influenced by the time that they were written in?
Right. So you were mentioning Shostakovich's second piano trio, which was written, I think, during the siege of Leningrad. A very harrowing piece in which he tries to depict a feeling of being under pressure, a feeling of suffering, a feeling of sparseness and weariness and anguish about the future and sorrow about what was happening to Jewish people at the time and generally the sort of a very bleak and wintry picture. And I have sometimes wondered, why did he choose only three people to present such a picture in music? And I think it's actually something to do with the fact that just a small group of people with just one on each instrument, one pianist, one violinist, and one on the cello, and the three of them are trying to present this enormous canvas, this enormous portrait of Russia at a time of great suffering, that makes it very touching if it's well done. But Shostakovich is an interesting example because a lot of his music is concerned with that period of Russian history, Soviet history. And I once heard a young string quartet playing a string quartet by Shostakovich, which depicts the same period of Russian history. They obviously didn't know a thing about it. They had just learned the music from the notes and they just played what they saw in front of them on the page. And I was rather taken aback by the fact that the musical message did not seem to come across. And this was at a masterclass. The person who was giving the masterclass, who was himself Russian, said to them that they had to understand what the music was trying to portray, and that when there was very little going on, it didn't mean that it was empty. It didn't mean that it was quiet. It might mean that it was bleak. It might mean that they were, you know, there were no words for what they were experiencing. And of course, once they started to understand a bit of the background, it affected the way that they played. It affected the way that they looked. You could see that they were trying to feel in themselves, you know, what might be behind the notes on the page. And the whole thing suddenly started to acquire a different dimension. And that was very interesting to observe, because I think there is some music that is not associated with historical events. It's abstract. It's abstract music. And you don't really need to know what was going on in Schubert's life to understand the poetry and artistry of his piano music. But there is some music which is more, say, specifically attached to a historical event or era, where it does help. It's essential to understand, you know, what motivated the composer to write that. What was he trying to convey? He was trying to give us a sense in music of what it was like to be there. And that's where, you know, obviously music education is so important.
You have a whole section on jazz. And I wanted to ask about how that shook up attitudes to not only how the piano should be played, but also how piano music should be written and interpreted as well.
Yes, that's very interesting, because of course the whole history of jazz, or let's say we're to start with ragtime, which is slightly preceding jazz as we know it, ragtime and piano what they called piano novelty music, say in the 1920s, and then on with jazz. A lot of it was improvised rather than written down. And so that developed a different sort of playing. And a lot of very, very talented pianists who learned by ear, played by listening to other people and memorizing what they had heard. A lot of them, especially the African-American pianists who specialized in jazz, they were extremely good players and very, very quick musically and could, you know, do so much just by listening and remembering, improvising on what they'd heard, elaborating on what they'd heard, that they developed really a whole style of their own, often playing on pianos which were not of the greatest quality, you know, pianos that might be found in bars, cafes, and clubs, and yet they managed to extract, you know, such a lot from the pianos of their day, and they even managed to use the honky tonk sound of some of those pianos to their own advantage, you know, in music which is rhythmically and percussive and sparkling and rhythmically exciting. They sort of managed to get the best out of those old pianos.
In the introduction to the book, you acknowledge that feeling, you say, frustrated at the relatively small amount of women that you can feature in this list. But who are some of those important women in the history of the piano? And what were some of the challenges to them playing as well?
Yeah, it's true. It's actually it's a very sad thing, actually, when you come to study the history of any kind of music, actually. But the whole of classical music, any book, any list of composers is largely composed of men. That was because of society's attitudes towards women and what they should be doing with their time, you know, what they were allowed to do. It was not seemly for them to perform in public. And there were, throughout history, there have been many women who were very good pianists, but were not encouraged or allowed to play outside the home. And the same with composers. There have been women who managed to teach themselves or be taught how to compose, but they were not supposed to publish their music. They were not supposed to have their music performed. And for example, the 19th century composer Felix Mendelssohn had a sister, Fanny Mendelssohn, who was probably as talented as him, both as a pianist and as a composer. But her whole family, her father, her brother, they all thought that it was not permissible for her to publish her music. And indeed, when Felix Mendelssohn agreed that some of his sister's music could be published under his name, so it went out as being by Felix Mendelssohn, although it was in fact by Fanny. And there was a rather delightful incident where Mendelssohn came to London and met Queen Victoria. Queen Victoria was fond of singing and asked if Mendelssohn would play the piano for her when she sang a song. And then she said, "I'm going to sing one of my favourite songs of yours," she said. And then she said which song it was and began to sing it. And Felix Mendelssohn had to realise that it was actually a song by his sister. He nobly decided to admit to the Queen that it was actually not by him, but by his sister. And so she got an unexpected bit of advertising in the drawing room of Queen Victoria. But actually, she had to take a backseat completely with her compositions, which, you know, and many of which are probably lost to us, but some of them are known today and are being played today. And she's, you know, she has so much to say, but she was not allowed to say it at the time. And the same went for many, many other women who tried to compose.
And something that I had never even really realized, of course it's so obvious until I read the book, is that the piano as an instrument is designed for male hands.
Yes, I'm glad you picked up on that, because I put that in the introduction with a certain amount of trepidation, because and I actually have never seen it stated just quite as sort of boldly as I stated it, that most piano music was written by men for their own hands, or expecting that their music would be played by other men with typical male hands. And there are women who have large hands, and just as there are men who have small hands, but generally speaking, the male hand is on a slightly larger scale than the female hand. And so For a lot of piano music, particularly of the Romantic era, where they're using wider intervals and they require greater stretches between individual fingers to get your hands on big chords, that is easier for men. It just is, because they can more easily stretch. For example, the Russian composer Rachmaninoff, end of the 19th century, had an enormous hand, and he wrote music which his own hand could play. So he could stretch something like an octave and a fifth, which is, you know, a stretch that I could never manage. I can stretch an octave, and if I'm given time to stretch my hand a little bit more, I can put my hands on an octave plus one note. That's all. So I could not possibly put down the chords that Rachmaninoff played all at one moment. I would have to go ba-ba-ba-bum. And that means that for me, a lot of romantic music, I have to, as they say, spread the chords, meaning to ripple from the bottom to the top. It just makes a different effect. And I think, yeah, I think a lot more needs to be sort of thought about women and what music which is adapted to women's hands. And I don't mean that it should be scaled down in any other way than you know, physically. Just, I'm talking about just the sheer size of the hand. I don't think that it should be music which is dainty, you know, dainty, delicate, or in any way, you know, inferior to music which is written for men. But I do think it's an issue which is perhaps not, you know, it's not sufficiently recognized.
Finally, if you could pick three pieces to see performed in their original setting, what would you want to go back in the time machine and see?
One thing I would love to have seen is, this is one of the first pieces I talk about in the book, Bach's Goldberg Variations, which was written at the request of a patron, a musical patron called Goldberg, who had trouble sleeping and employed a young harpsichordist to play music to him in the night, to entertain him if he couldn't sleep. And this set of variations was written by Bach, a very elaborate set of variations which uses all manner of different ways of varying the original theme and gets more and more virtuosic, but is also very cleverly contrasted, so that just as you're thinking, you know, is it always going to be fast, it changes to, you know, the most gorgeous slow music, you know, that you can imagine, and, you know, and then into something dancey, and then into a serious fugue, and so on. All that was apparently mastered and played in the middle of the night by a young harpsichordist who could only have been a teenager at the time by his, you know, if historical research is right. And I would love to have been there in the middle of the night listening to this music being played to entertain someone who suffered from insomnia. You know, what would that have sounded like? It would just be such a sort of fascinating scene to be a fly on the wall. That's one. I would love to have heard Frédéric Chopin at some of his concerts, because we have some wonderful descriptions of how he played. For example, the English Sir Charles Halle, whose name we know from the Halle Orchestra. Charles Halle was present at a concert where Chopin played and said that it was so enchanting that he wouldn't have been surprised to look up and see that the room was filled with fairies. It just seemed it had suggested such magical things to him. And he said that he could just have fallen down at Chopin's feet and kissed them. He was so entranced. And, you know, that's a wonderful description to read, but how wonderful to be able to hear the performance which inspired it. You know, that would be great. And then a third one might be, this is from the realm of jazz, actually, the African-American blind jazz pianist Art Tatum. I would love to have been in one of the bars or clubs where Art Tatum played the piano, because he was such a, he had mastered the technique of the piano to such an extraordinary extent, despite being almost entirely blind. And he had a surety of touch on the piano, which you would think, you know, how does that go along with being blind? Surely if you're blind, you might be more tentative about the way you moved about the piano keyboard. But with him, it was the opposite. He obviously had internalized the layout of the piano in such a way that he could rush up and down the piano keyboard and play the most incredibly virtuoso and elaborate things at any speed, and going in and out of different keys as it occurred to him, to modulate from one key into another and back again. And he was so renowned at the time that when he was playing in the clubs of New York, visiting artists such as Rachmaninoff and the pianist Vladimir Horowitz and so on, they used to, when they finished their own concerts, they used to go along to these clubs in New York and just sit and listen to Art Tatum playing the piano because they admired him. And I would love to have been there, you know, one of those evenings with Art Tatum playing and Rachmaninoff and Horowitz sitting having a beer in the audience and admiring that. I think that would be something to see.
That was Susan Tomes. Her book, The Piano, A History in 100 Pieces, is out now, published by Yale University Press. And as I mentioned earlier, Susan will be launching the book with a concert at Wigmore Hall on this Friday, the 23rd of July. You can find a link for that and the book in the show notes. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. Tune in again tomorrow when I'll be speaking to Alex Renton about his book Blood Legacy, which shares the story of his family's involvement in the slave trade.
Hi, Tom Baudet here for Studio 6. I thought I'd play a little game with you. He's a 6, but has clean, comfortable rooms, a kitchen to cook in, fresh coffee to brew, great Wi-Fi. Oh, and he loves to do long-term. 10, right? I'd say Studio 6 is definitely a 10. I'm Tom Baudet for Studio 6, but really 10, where you get more in your room and less on your bill.